listening to a program produced in 2010 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. We kind of mentioned this in the brochure with the words imagination, luminosity, mystery and grief, ghost landscapes, joy and celebration, a reading by three award-winning California poets. And I know that all of those elements will be present tonight. We are going to begin with Ralph Angel, who is the author of four books of poetry, Exceptions and Melancholies, Poems 1986 to 2006, which won the 2007 Penn USA Poetry Award, Twice Removed, Neither World, 1995 award from the American Academy of Poets, and Anxious Latitudes, as well as a translation of the Federico Garcia Lorca collection Poema del Cante Hondo, Poem of the Deep Song. His poems have been widely anthologized and appeared in scores of magazines here and abroad, and he's received many literary awards, including a Pushcart Prize, a Gertrude Stein Award, and a Fulbright. He is the Edith R. White Distinguished Professor of English and Creative Writing at the University of Redlands and a member of the MFA program in writing faculty at the Vermont College of Fine Arts. And I just wanted to read this beautiful quote from Gene Valentine, which is on the back of his beautiful collection, Exceptions and Melancholies. Ralph Angel's poetry is inventive in its language and its look at things. It is free and alive. It is like no one else's, and it belongs to everyone. Exceptions and Melancholies is a marvelous and strange collection of poems that we can only be thankful for, their wisdom, their loneliness, and their company over the years. Please welcome Ralph Angel.
I'm Ralph. I'm an alcoholic. It's nice to be here. And and to be reading with two terrific poets and dear friends. Am I... Really? Okay. How's that? Is that good? Am I too loud? You don't know what it sounds like in here. I can't begin tonight without acknowledging something you already know, which is 2 weeks ago we entered the ninth year of this war. We're ratcheting it up. 257,000 Americans are occupying other countries. I don't know where we've come. And I say that not for ideological reasons, but for the fact that we no longer talk about it in this country. Blackouts. Blackouts rolled through the city. Whoever has an answer won't last. Traffic muscles through, whole families lazing on steps eating grapes. No, I'm not, says the youngest to her canary. You grew into your legs, tall one, didn't you? Then no one, loosed papers flatten the fences, bits of glass rest there and burn. This part of nature runs along ridges, sprouts wings in the valleys and wanders the world like a candle. A general steps down from his pedestal. Everyone hated that statue. She points left and says right. She could be an orchid. All those seen from afar moving away from the market. This part of nature breaks down the butterfly. This part of man into flutes. Flop through your branches, naked one. In room after room, your strangers have raised you. What's fair is fair. The police didn't do anything to them. Legs in stockings with flowers, windows in plants, the potting shed. Some children have to run away in the middle of the night to join the circus. Some people stand around forever, it seems, alongside the airport conveyor belt. Here in the tissue paper, sunlight and silence flap their wings. The god who wanted to be a truck driver takes out a fruit stand. He knows what you're thinking. The traffic's bad. Take the money, bunny. What are you wearing? The weather's old and personal. It doesn't have an end. That's the bottom line. Excuse me. Vertigo. Only one is a wanderer. And when she was sad, she'd go into the street to be with people. Two together are always going somewhere. They lie down beneath cypress, next to a bird. I imagine the sky. It fans her mountains and waves. She'd left some small town where they used to make tires. Stories are made out of stairwells and rope. I'd been interrupting for years and didn't know it. This old park, the dark hatchery, workers in jumpsuits throw down their poison at dawn. Not everyone can be described. It's perfectly natural. If she's thinking about love, does she break down the door of the bedroom? Of course not. Not publicly speaking. To the left, there's a sofa. We all lived in rented rooms. That's how it goes with subject matter. Nude figures in profile floating among palm trees. The idea was touristy, like a postcard. I was given a small auditorium. I watched over rush hour. I write down everything as I forget it, especially at night. I lock the door from the inside. Sorry. Breathing out. Now you're crossing a wide street at night, anxious in the traffic and rushing to get to the bakery before closing. What could be more breathtaking than your beauty, if not in my arms, at least on that side of peril? That's why I'm yelling at the driver of the pickup truck I just slammed into, so much did I want to park there and wait for you. May I never live with love. By surviving love and loving blocks and days away, the most ancient of the dead desire earthly are getting born again, alone, without choice, children fill the air. The spices in the rugs of the bazaar. I buy you tulips. They are yellow and bright. The port is dark and glittering blue airplanes hover there. Like clarity itself. Like faintly wailing sirens attached to absolutely nothing. like socks and sweaters and the blanket that slipped somehow from your legs while I tidied up the balcony. So lost in your book are you tonight. There are many poems in this book, this new book, that don't have titles yet. So I'm pleased to read you a few of them tonight. I'm desperate for titles. Here's a short one. I made this poem in Dallas a short time ago. I rarely compose anything outside the sanctuary of my study here in the city. And after making a poem in Dallas, I realized that's the last town I'll ever make a poem in again. Are any of you from Dallas? Good. Good. I wouldn't even visit if I were you. Short poem. Were you guilty of something, your story would wear a black suit and come to an end. I leave you alone. I mop up the afterlife and slick back its hair. The sun blows so hard the leaves have returned to their trees. Their eyes are wide open. Saltwater fish slide through the streets. The pedestrian said there was sad, and oh, how it would be more interesting to paint her skin and hair were I naked now and am. Another untitled poem. Trees laced and bare against the sky. The sky. A few green leaves against it. The light is night. In the city one steps over all sorts of things. 26 birds in the mail. It's breezy cold. In hell, they die in summer homes above their diaries. The suicides especially should not bother you. We like the shitty squad cars. People crowd the photo booth so that it might be said. And if you're nuts, you'll edit this so as not to overwhelm your body from afar. Sooner or later, I'm out folding chairs again, and so leave myself behind. Though flirting with an angel a few stairs above me feels just as real and keeps things moving. A golden retriever licks my hand. It's Christmas in Chicago. The family's here, and from the cemetery there's talk of food and family. It's flat and cold in Dallas, and then a bursting cloud of grackles. An old man pees himself. His wife takes her seat and thanks me. In Louisville, Kentucky, a baby's handed me. In Seattle, must I go there too? I'm here for you, and I know I won't be back. It's a poem for the great American minimalist painter Agnes Martin. Agnes. Here comes perfection. When I think of art, I think of beauty. I put my arm around it. Around my mind, I mean. You may as well give up judging what you've done. The day is young. The gray sun stayed that way. Here comes an iron shade, partly down. Their heads are gone. Please don't print the negative. I love their shoes. It's where the light is. The great fires have lit. On the head of a bald man, the story's been told. More difficult were the paintings, which required a warehouse and many assistants. I never know what I'm thinking until I see what I've done and then have to do it all over again. Shrubs of a feather get together, and that's what I'm working on. No birds hunkered down. The gnats here bite in the morning. We're building new bodies all the time. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ralph, for that beautiful reading. We're going to hear next from Cecilia Wallach. Cecilia divides her time. I think this is an interesting fact about Cecilia. She really does divide her time between Los Angeles, Paris, Kentucky, and a small town in the Carpathian Mountains in Eastern Europe. And when I figure out how she does it, I plan to follow in her footsteps. Cecilia is a celebrated teacher. She has conducted poetry workshops for thousands of children throughout the United States and around the world, as well as workshops for professional writers, educators, senior citizens, prison inmates, and homeless women and their children. Since 2006, she has been a lecturer in the creative writing program at USC. She is the author of Carpathia, Sacrifice, Zigan, the Gypsy Poem, and Late, for which she was named Georgia Author of the Year for Poetry in 2004, and a chapbook, Narcissus. Her poems are anthologized widely, and you may have heard them read aloud on Garrison Keillor's Writer's Almanac. And this beautiful quote about Cecilia, I thought, was a nice lead into her her reading. Cecilia Wallach receives the world right on her skin, responds to it with her whole physical being, and fearlessly in all its mystery and beauty, and also in its sadness and cruelty and disappointment. Please welcome Cecilia Wallach.
This kind of stage makes me nervous. Once I was reading at the Jimmy Carter Center, and they had a, and all of my students from the class I was teaching at Emory were arrayed in the front of the auditorium, and it had this wooden floor. And then at the edges, it had some carpeting. And so you had to be really careful of your footing, and I wasn't. And as I finished my reading, and I stepped to the edge of the stage, and I stepped from the carpeted onto the wooden or the vice versa, and I did a grand jeté. I was really wearing my very best undergarments, so it was okay. But I could see the faces of my students as I came. They were like, we don't want to know that about you. Thank you, Ralph, for that beautiful reading. This is a really powerful mic. I sort of feel like the voice of God. I also feel like Miss Janie because I can hold up my mirror and see who's in the audience. And wonderful to see you. I'm going to read just from Carpathia this evening. And because Ralph pointed out to us that it is not much after the 8th anniversary of the invasion of Iraq, I thought I would read my poem from the when the Bush administration invaded Iraq, I had the good fortune to be in Paris with a lot of poet friends. So this poem is for those poet friends. My glasses are so dirty that I actually see better without them. Shine. In such dark times, we all need to shine, each to each with what light we have, as dusk like a smoky curtain falls from east to west across the world, and the world grows dim with news of war, and the headlines blacken our fingertips, and the wicks of candles burnt to char. Among these monuments and shadows, friends, let us suffer our radiance. In this city in which I once loved my beloved, in hunger, the brasseries shine, and the neon of San Michel casts a glow like dawn on the ancient walls, and the wine in our glasses, ruby and bright, and the teeth of the waiter when he smiles, and our voices like coins in our throats, and our laughter silver as ever, and all our tears, useless and beautiful, shine. And the Seine gleams darkly past, dragging its net of drowning stars. And the half moon, tarnished gold, slides through the ragged map of clouds. And somewhere the sky being torn into sheets of flame and shrieking shines. And the paving stones shine beneath the clatter of our heels and the courtyard's hush. And the window of one room blue glows in the loneliness of its night. And the flickering light of the TV screen buzzes and shines with its shining lies. And our reflections thrown back from the glass, our ghosts in the gilt-framed mirrors, shine. And our prayers, which are nothing, shine. And the bones of the dead in the earth's black loam, and the flowers on graves with their dumb, sweet tongues, and my wedding band, small and gold, still whole, and the whole bloody planet glimpsed through the eye of what God may yet squint through the stars at us, shines. Postcard with Sarah, to Sarah. From a bridge in Paris. Which? It's late and we've stopped to lean against the rail of the Pont Marie, or the Pont Louis Philippe, or some other bridge. Which bridge? It's cloudy, the moon is veiled, or it's clear but we can't see the Tour Eiffel. Below us on the quay, there's a kind of party going on. Someone's about to fall into the river, or about to plunge, or he's being pushed, or no, it was only a game, after all. See? They're laughing, a joke among friends. My friend who leans beside me is saying she wants another child. Now she's sure of it. A boy. Or another girl, like the girl she has. Or different, more like the father this time, or darker, like herself. What does it matter? Either one. Either one of us could be the others sometimes, in shadow like this. She sighs. We both stare down at the glittering river, knowing we'll find no answers there. We've agreed there's no right or wrong, no answers at all when it comes to love. And there are so many we might have loved, might yet love, or love again. Her husband, she says, still recovering from the shock of her being his wife. I'm not winking, it's just my eye, and we're falling down laughing, we're standing here. So beautiful, one of us says, or the other thinks, the river, the wind. It's cold, and our coats are thin. It's spring, and the blossoms the trees breathe scatter like petals of snow at our feet. It's the middle of our lives and night, and we walk toward everything. Anniversary. Didn't I stand there once, white-knuckled, gripping the just-lit taper, swearing I'd never go back.
And hadn't you kissed the rain from my mouth? And weren't we gentle and awed and afraid, knowing we'd stepped from the room of desire into the further room of love? And wasn't it sacred, the sweetness we licked from each other's hands? And were we not lovely then? Were we not as lovely as thunder and damp grass and flame? This is a very small poem that is ekphrastic. It came from an installation by Melanie Braverman called Have Broken Up. What is this? It's a pillow for the invisible, a pillow for shadows, a pillow for ghosts. It's a pillow against which the heads of the dead are lain to awaken them. The edges have been stitched by hand by angels using thorns. See this whiteness, broken only by itself? It isn't sky. It isn't even what you thought asleep you were, those clouds you dreamed. A page on which the words "Je t'embrasse" appear, then fade. The luminous surface startles like water, across which no such wind has swept. Postcard to Lisa, with Lisa, from Metro Line 1. No one had seen him before he fell, but we saw the man fall to his knees in the aisle of the train, then face down as if in prayer, forehead pressed to the filthy floor. Someone gasped. Someone called out, "Monsieur, monsieur." Someone tried to lift him up, but he lurched and fell back the other way, backwards, hitting the back of his head. That's when we saw the gash in his scalp. Was it a fresh wound or a scar? There was no blood. He did not seem drunk. A neatly dressed, dark-skinned man, though the cuffs of his trousers were frayed. Someone tumbled him into a seat, and he sat there and would not or could not speak. I reached over and pulled the alarm. The doors slid open, but no one came. I leapt from the car and ran down the quay and rapped the glass conductor's cage. The conductor was standing inside in darkness, watching the scene on a little screen. I could not think of what to say in French. Un homme, il est tombé. And then he was standing over the dazed man, naming the stations of the metro, asking where the man wanted to go. But the man wouldn't talk. His eyes stayed closed. A clochard stepped onto the car, drunk and smelling of vomit and piss. He started yelling, trying to help. The other passengers cleared a path. Some had just sat there all along, a young girl clipping her fingernails furiously, clippings falling into her lap. The dazed man was taken out onto the quay, still not speaking. The train pulled away. The clochard had stayed on board, and now he was filling the car with his stench. Someone leaned over my seat and whispered in English, "This doesn't happen here that much." Mistake. It's for my father. Near the end, he thought he saw death, near the door where his dark robe hung. But it was only his robe in the dark. It was only the door. It was only his death. Come for him, and near. Sleep, I begged him, sleep. And he lifted one hand into the air, pale hand, almost blue in that dark, as if waving hello or goodbye or trying to touch his own life as it passed. This is another ekphrastic poem. There's two photographers whose work I really love. They happen to be twins, Peter Turnley and David Turnley, and they've both spent
considerable time in Eastern Europe. So this is a poem from a photograph by David Turnley entitled Brasov, which is in Romania. Brasov, 1989. The women are waiting in line to confess, standing or slumping or leaning on canes, or half crouched, backs pressed to the wall of a wooden church in Brasov, Romania. It's the year of our Lord, 1989, 6 months before all hell will break loose, and the brute who starved them, a nation of starvelings, will be shot point blank in the head. The women's faces are calm or grim. One might wonder, where are the men? But the light is golden, warm, diffuse, as if all sins once confessed or desires, who has butter today, has meat and egg, could be left at the feet of a wooden saint with a whisper, a kiss, a prayer for forgiveness, because we've been broken, because we've obeyed. Whoever needs to cough, go ahead and cough. Really loud. It always feels so sympathetic with somebody who needs to cough. This is another postcard. When I first started to travel in Poland in the early 90s, Louise and I share a strange passion for travel in Poland. And I've got news for you. I think I'm going back to Wrocław in May. So, but, you know, when I first started to travel in Poland in the early 90s, it was very similar to all my nightmares, all the nightmares I had as a little girl about what things looked like behind the Iron Curtain. It really did look like an old black and white movie. It was quite terrifying. It was so gray. But things, you know, you sort of got to see color begin to come back. And I used to stay with a friend who, for a time, lived on a street called Ulica Piękna, pretty street, okay? And there was an old flower seller there I fell in love with. So this is for her. And we all know what happened in Poland after the reason it's, one of the reasons it's so, well, the reason it was so horrible is, you know, the Nazis pretty much flattened everything. And then the communist government that came in rebuilt the country to look mostly like a prison. There were a few nice buildings, but those were only for the apparatchiks. So that was the landscape in which I was spending time when I wrote this poem. Postcard to X from Warsaw. Ulica Piękna, pretty street. The old woman selling flowers next to the archway at Ulica Piękna was wearing orange lipstick today. Shiny orange lipstick and a smile. Her black kerchief knotted under her chin. She was smoking a cigarette, all her tulips arranged in plastic tubs at her feet, gaudily purple and yellow and red. I could tell she felt quite the coquette, and it made her mouth look lovely, in fact. That slick of peach on her lips as she sat with her back to the flat gray wall. The building behind her, a relic, too. My friend says the communist built these apartments, quote, to show the workers how they might live, though only the highest officials, most brutal, most damned, were given such balconies, of course. Everyone else in the dreary blocks built on the ash of the murdered, the crushed, stinking forever of cabbage and piss. But today there was rain here in Warsaw, then sun. The wind had shifted, then shifted again. The clouds moved like swans across the sky. And the old woman, I passed her twice, made a few zlotys on flowers, I'd guess. She sat there for hours on Pretty Street, her mouth like a pearl in her wrinkled face. And you know who you are. You tried to be human once, but you failed.
could not have touched this woman, ever. She, with her tulips, not bitter, nor I. Salt. What you wanted from salt was salt. What you wanted from each of the bones of my hand was touch like a river, smoke. What you wanted from smoke was the holy body, ghostly to the mind. What you wanted from the body was a body that would not die. What you wanted from fire was heat and light, but also char, the flare of sparks. What you wanted I had to give, but to make it small enough to crush. What you wanted to crush was the quick hand, river, birds, the field in flames. And then what you wanted was salt, a woman weeping at your back. But you could not turn to look. I think I'll read two more poems. And the question is, which two? I'll read a. I was thinking of reading this pen too, for Pierre and Isabel, if I can find it. Yes. Pantoum, Le Jardin d'Isabelle. The first line is halfway stolen from H.D., who wrote, "The love of my lover for his mistress." The love of my lover for his wife, his name being stone, the word for stone, and her name like a flower, Isabel, who has thrown herself into the garden this summer, made it a paradise. His name is the stone I polished in my mouth all winter long, Pierre, as in Peter, who stands at the gate, who welcomes me into the garden this summer she's made a paradise. And I come bearing the little sin of sweet Alyssum, love them both, Pierre, she calls Peter, who stands at the gate, and Isabel coming toward me now, knee-deep in the shimmering grass. I have brought them the little sin of sweet Alyssum, love them both, and beloved, welcomed, slip into the shade between them, kissed by the child who's come rushing toward me, waist-deep in the shimmering grass, and lifted into my arms, names me Tanta of weeds and wind, and beloved, laughing, slips into the shade between us, blessed, the love of this man for this woman, and this woman for this child. And lifting out of my arms the crushed bouquet of weeds and wind, and calling it luck, the glass I shatter in the offering of wine. This man who loves this woman, who loves this woman, who loves this child, offers me a place at love's long table, not cast out, and calling it luck. The glass I shatter in the offering of wine and the love of my lover for his wife and my place among them here at love's long table, not cast out. I name every flower Isabel. I'll finish with one last little postcard. Postcard to myself from the Lower Carpathians, spring. I slept in a room filled with white moths, in a wooden house in the Lower Carpathians, beskid niski, each silvery night. I made my bed in the room's far corner, white moths settling like quiet petals on every surface as evening fell. They folded their wings and clung to the walls without a quiver as I undressed. I knew, as soon as I switched off the lamp, that the air would go pale with their fluttering. I knew, in my sleep, one might light on my arm, on my cheek, in my hair, without waking me. In this room also, the seeds of wildflowers gleaned from the meadows were spread out to dry. What I learned about gentleness then. what I learned to be gently less wary of. I want not to forget those nights in the lower Carpathians, deep spring, sleeping alone, the white moths swirling as I dreamt, the meadows bearing themselves to the moon. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Cecilia and Ralph and Carol, soon to read. I realize that being in the presence of poetry, you know, after all the day and all that's in the day, and it's like finally you can feel your heart opening and your breath slowing and your ears opening, and it's really such a gift. I want to thank our poets so much tonight. All three of our poets will be signing their books in the lobby afterwards, and although we usually do a Q&A, we're doing it slightly differently tonight. After the readings, we'll just adjourn, and you can take that wonderful feeling with you off into the night. It is my great honor to introduce Carol Muskie Dukes, who's going to read next. Carol is the author of 7 books of poetry, including Sparrow and An Octave Above Thunder, New and Selective Poems. Her 3 novels are Life After Death, Saving St. Germ, and Dear Digby, and I think we don't have down there Channeling Mark Twain, because this is an older bio, which is a fabulous book. Her collection of essays entitled Married to the Icepick Killer, A Poet in Hollywood, was published in August of 2002, and her work really has appeared everywhere from The New Yorker to LA Magazine. She's been anthologized in many, many publications. She's a professor of English and creative writing and the founding director of the PhD program in literature and creative writing at USC. She's received many honors, including a Guggenheim Fellowship, the Witter Brinner Award from the Library of Congress, and several Pushcart Prizes. And as I'm sure most of you here know, on November 13th, 2008, Governor Schwarzenegger appointed Carol as California's Poet Laureate. This beautiful volume, Sparrow, and I think she might read a few from Sparrow tonight, perhaps. I love this little review from the Los Angeles Times Book Review. Carol Muskie Dukes is that wonderful, rare thing, a poet who has the ability to deepen the secrets of experience even while revealing them. It's a great honor to welcome Carol Muskie Dukes. Thank you.
Thank you, Louise. Thank you all for being here. I like that Louise was saying, take a deep breath. We can all sort of slow down. Our ears will open. And now you can fall asleep. Sorry. No. I did. I make big joke. Sorry. I'm going to be reading, as Louise suggested, a couple of poems from Sparrow. Then I will read from a new book of poems that will be published in 2011 called Twin Cities. So let me read just a couple from Sparrow. This is called Passport. This is your passport I hold in my hand, a hemisphere half red ink, half blue. As yet untorched by terror, but polluted perhaps by the gaze of the future. For example, the shadow of the parachute of my desire, this ripcord rip of your photo blink, your eyes translated into these flashing, sad idioms. Take this blank page for the remainder, the last boring national tattoos. Wave me through these invisible brackets of lightning. Stars shatter on the epaulets of all the uniforms, the hats and coats of countries that no longer exist. I wear your insignia, therefore I wear death's insignia, which means that nothing can hurt me. And with these wings and flames, I pledge allegiance to nothing. I can go anywhere. My late husband, to whom many of the poems, well, in fact, just about all the poems in this book, are inspired by and in some sense dedicated to their elegies for David, was an actor. And the next poem I'm going to read is about sitting with a group of actors and having them talk about their least favorite roles that they had to play. And it turns out that nobody likes to play Romeo. They just, you know, he's considered, well, you'll see what he's considered, but then they, you know, I was sitting with this group of people and they went on to talk, these actors, and they went on to talk about other roles that were really challenging in a bad way. I also quote from Romeo and Juliet the lines, "Come night, come Romeo, come loving black-browed night," and I've told this story before. I read this poem once, and a young woman came up to me after the reading and said, "I really like that poem, Romeo, especially your lines, 'Come night, come Romeo.'" I said, "Thank you." Worked on those for a while. Romeo. "Romeo is a wanker," you say. The other actors lift their glasses, recalling grunting battles with Capulets fought in battery-lit cod pieces. Somebody cast as Richard Crookback recounts popping his air-filled hump. It's shriveling like a balloon on his back. Nobody ever wants to sing, "Try to remember the kind of September" again. Slick cads, kings, Hollywood whores, psychos all shot by the messenger. The actors brandish their glasses. What brushes against the glass mouths is wind, slamming shut the skylight, the lit trapdoor above that leads to heavens, resembling a parenthesis between identities where players wait to be cast. Come night, come Romeo, come loving black-browed night. This is the space between. Take him and cut him out in little stars so that all the world will be in love with sweet audition. The glasses float again, catching the great light, the friar's lifted filter of fire, Juliet's eyes. Their voices rise in hectoring chorus in the dreamy interlude before the coming acts. Oh, Romeo, wanker, Romeo. May come back to that one. The poems in Twin Cities I got really tired of writing about grief, about you know, being sad or just being pensive about life. So I tried to write some funny poems that are also in Sparrow. The idea of the book was not so much of Sparrow was that it would not be a document of grief so much, I hoped, as a kind of meditation on the two arts of acting and poetry. And I'm not sure if it worked, but I felt to some degree escaped the utter elegy. But that these poems in Twin Cities, I think, try to move away a little bit more. This is a poem, one of the title poems. I actually have about three title poems. This one is called Twin Cities One or something like that. I was born in St. Paul, Minnesota, and if you know about the Twin Cities there, the Mississippi River flows between. And this is a kind of a story poem about something that really happened. I tell my students not to say, people say, you know, argue with you after they write a poem in a workshop and say, "It really happened like this," but it doesn't matter, of course, but this did really happen. And I, in fact, had to change. There's a reference to an actual person. I had to change the name. Twin Cities. It was the river that made them two, the mills on one side, the cathedral on the other. We watched its swift currents. If we stared long enough, maybe it would stop cold and let us skate across to the other side. It never froze in place, though I once knew a kid, a wild, funny girl, who built a raft from branches which promptly sank a few feet out from the elbow bend off Dayton's Bluff, who made it seem easy to believe. We had tried to break into Carver's Cave, where bootleggers once hid their hot stash, years after the Dakota drew their snakes and bears on the rock walls and canoed inside the caverns. We knew there were other openings in the cliffs, mirroring those same rock faces on the other shore. And below them, the caves, the subterranean pathways underlying the talk and commerce, the big-shot churches, undermining the false maidenliness of the convent school from which my friend was eventually expelled for being too smart and standing up for her own smartness. Too late, I salute you, Katie McNally. I think that the river returned then to two-sidedness, an overhung history of bottle flash and hopelessness. I see you still, laughing as the lashed sticks sank beneath you, laughing as you did that morning when the river lifted its spring shoulders, shrugging off the winter ice, that thin, brittle mirage, making you believe we were all in this together. I have been, I admit, bicoastal. This is called two coasts. I own them both. Sometimes I wake up in somebody else's night, somebody else's day. I enjoy entering the lives of no one I know. You learn to live in transit, feel like the safety on a gun. I've been on the run since he stopped drawing breath. You want to be with me? Boarding pass is my answer. So every democracy of one's life has a little tyrant time, perpetual motion, within my own shadow, away from me. I pledge allegiance to it. Beauty, beauty, skyscraper caverns, the gold riprap of heels on pavement, silver Chrysler headdress, jeweled fan of Korean fruits, times dropped like a baby on the tracks. Once underground in the sky, then desert by the sea, backlot, blue jacaranda boulevards, a house afloat on earth, many houses rippling like the screen coming down in the screening room of someone I call pal. Oh, my pal is a vampire. Sky high on Sunset Boulevard, showing his choppers. Come to me, bloodlust, better yet, good coffee on either side of the country. Blue ambassador, I believe in myself, like a law book studied in solitary. I want to be in as much as I want out. Sorry. I'm going to read a poem that was... Actually, I was sort of amazed by the fact that I remembered a word in a language I have no concept of at all. But I was once in Kashmir years and years ago, and what I was doing there is complicated. But I, among other things, I was writing a journalistic piece for Ms. Magazine, the then extant Ms. Magazine, and I wanted to go, because the person I was with wanted to go trout fishing in the Himalayas. I know. So, Kashmir then, as it is now, is a Muslim country, and they didn't understand. I mean, there were shikari, or guides, who would take tourists up into the mountains and then fish for trout in the white water. And I couldn't go as a woman, so I had to sort of dress up and... I tried to look like a boy, okay? It was a long time ago. And they called me boy. The guides called me boy because they couldn't deal with the fact that, you know, I might secretly be a woman. So this poem is called Boy. They called me boy in Kashmiri because they had no other word for what I appeared to them to be. Taller by a half foot, gawky in my rolled jeans and cap, they chose to look away from my small breasts and voice lilt and rename me in the lexicon of sex. The shikari, mysterious, wizened in loose turbans, were our guides, up the mountain and through the wall of white water. They linked arms with us and waded us through to the high, still pools above, where we cast for trout. They stepped in and out of Allah, as we climbed in sun and shade, singing his name. We were miles above Srinagar and 200 miles from China, and the finned bodies were swift under the surface. The shikari pointed, Bundegard, big fish. Then they murmured their one word for me, and it was not sister or daughter. I was naked face, 27, a rebel, I thought. Therefore, they made me their oversight. Had they not looked away from me as they spoke, had it been otherwise, they would have heard it above the peaks, the clear, unwavering call, a command to rip my cap away, to pick up stones, to separate my face from my face, stripping the veil from a hook of air, holding it over my breath till I gasped like a fish, till I was a pair of eyes on a plate, that body the world wishes both to savor and destroy. I was so proud that I, at this magazine where they have famous fact checkers, where it was published, I was right in remembering it was Bundegaard, Big Fish. I couldn't believe after all these years, this was like 700,000 years ago, I remembered that word sort of correctly. This is the next one I'm going to read. I hope I can find it. It's called Sati. Sati is a ritual in which, as you may know, it's a ritual in which a widow will throw herself. I don't know if she throws herself willingly, but she throws herself on the funeral pyre of her husband, and is burned with his body. I'm not convinced a lot of these women go willingly, you know. Actually, after having said that, I found the poem I originally wanted to read. I'm going to read, well, never mind, I'll read this one and then come back. Sati. Some go willingly, and there was a goddess, Sati, from whom the term Sati is taken. Sati. Some go willingly, some resist. The fire in which his body burns lights into her thin negligee, her hair. One way or another, she comes back from that pyre as ash. Sati, nonstop goddess, ignited herself like a lighter thumbed open, flame like a slit throat, gilt black, the copper red avenger. He wants to make love to you one last time. A widow I know made herself into a nerve kite, up, up in smoke, because he'd blown himself away and left her with a fury at him she could never express. Oh, she burns, burns in her own bones. What good are the earth's rickety steps hacked into the hillside? Ascend. Ascend, little sheep. He loves me. He loves me not. I try to stay a step ahead of the flames, but he's so fast, like his hand across my face, on my throat. The hem catches, then the stitching. His profile floats up from the raised platform. One gold ring, two, molten. I had that same dream, Sati, but now I swear I will not go willingly. This poem is, God, I keep saying this, this really happened, but I was sitting by a pool and I heard two young people talking about how to write a condolence note. They had someone sort of connected them and died, and they were looking at a book of, death etiquette or something, I don't know, Emily Post on death. Condolence note, Los Angeles. The sky is desert blue like the pool, secluded, no swimmers here, no smog. Unless you count this twisting brush fire in the hills, two kids sit head to head, poolside, rehearsing a condolence note. Someone has died. Not an intimate, perhaps a family friend, prompts the manners guide they consult. You shouldn't say, God never makes mistakes, she quotes, snapping her bikini top. Right, he adds, you could just say he's better off. or heaven was always in his future. There's always a better way to say we're sorry that he's dead, but now they're back inside their music. Pages of politeness fallen between them. Oh, do not say that the unsaid drifts over us like blown smoke. A single spark erupts in wildfire. Cup your hands. Blow out this wish for insight. Say, forgive me for living when you are dead. Say, pardon my need to praise without you this bright morning sky. It belongs to no one. But I offer it to you, heaven in your future, along with silent tunes from the playlist, the end time etiquette book dropped from the hand of the young sleeper. It's all we have left to share, the book of paid respects, the morning's hot blue iPod, sunlit words on a page, black border. Sorry, I hate when people do this. This is called The Invention of Your Face. I was waiting when you came back from Argentina. The summer you smuggled dulce de leche in your luggage. You talked about the film. You discovered how the proscenium shifted, haloing the body and the camera gaze, and how you emerged through that fluid arch each frame. You'd missed me. You'd missed her. 6 years old and suddenly shy in your presence. You spooned sweet milk paste from the tin into her cereal bowl, then let image after image appear for her through a camera lens you made of your hands, held like half-open wings in the air. She could see the great waterfall, Iguazu, and miles of hardwood trees called breakers of the axe, quebraco, as they swirled up in the Chaco, in one red horse galloping all by itself across the pampa. I watched her changing expressions. I knew how many nights she'd gone searching for you beyond the movable walls of a dream. You showed her a little bird that sang in Patagonia, wearing a gaucho's hat, and she ate sugar paste she barely tasted. She was a child. She took in whatever sweetness you provided, what sweetness there was in the world that we could see. Silent, the two of us, staring at you. We could never get past it, the invention of your face. I'm so sorry to do this to you. Why I didn't just take the poems I was going to read out and put them in a little pile, I don't know. River Road. River Road. So you had your share of summer nights, cars breaking fast along the River Road. The world was asleep yet alive with threat, the high, grieving sound of acceleration. Beauty grew too fast, like your body, ungainly, unfaithful. Along the River Road there were nodding lilacs. Every intersection dangerous, your life dangerous, but you didn't know then how damage is made. Not just the flipped, glittering chassis spun apart into anecdote, but night's notched up velocity ascending through a blue reservoir of scent. No, to remember the inevitable in terms of engaged, disengaged, gear to gear, one heightening judgment, is to forget that back then the worst happened each time it happened. What was speaking loud over the figure on the dash? That was God, or not God. Something flashing past each roadside presence, statue after gesturing statue, trying to reverse your belief in imagination as the opposite of fate. Imagine a speed at which you could make what was happening not be true, a speed at which you could bargain for it, that you, on fire from this minute forward, could be somebody else. I think I'm just going to read a couple more, and since I can't seem to find half of the poems I was going to read, I'll just read these two. Green River Cemetery is kind of a famous little cemetery. I am some of the time in East Hampton, New York, and this is a little cemetery where most of the abstract expressionist artists are buried, and also Frank O'Hara. And also Jean Stafford, whose wonderful fiction you may know. She was married as well to Robert Lowell. Unhappily married, I should say. Green River Cemetery, and there's a little bit of the famous epitaph from Frank O'Hara's grave. Grace, it's a longer epitaph, but grace to be born and to live variously, it says. Oh, his epitaph is happy, a small shoal of grace to be born and to live variously. A leap from the stark headstone Jean chose, the blank last page in her lightning style. Late friends, they lie in Green River, near where I often on live. Yet dying takes us far and variously, as Frank says, his tablet lying flat like a toy shield cast aside, its carved words brightening in sun. Sometimes I come here with awed poets who spend time among the names loitering as on the page, waiting for a phrase, lighting up a smoke, a touch of white space between characters. All around us are the wild plots of artists, painted boulders, signed mirrors, but the poets kneel down to read. Frank O'Hara, Jean Stafford, remember me, urges each epitaph. Remember yourself walking here among dreams and signatures, awake for a little while, biting like a caught breath, then drifting on the grounds of Green River. And I'm going to read The Parrot, Cecilia, and I totally embarrass myself. This is a poem that I wrote. Originally I wrote for kids, but, you know, what the hell. But then I decided that in this age when people don't memorize poetry anymore, or rarely memorize poetry, I'm not going to tell the story of my mother who came from that generation, the last generation of Americans maybe who learned poems by heart and can recite Tennyson and Milton and Dickinson and whatever, and that I encourage my own students to memorize. But I realize there's so many people walking around who haven't heard some of the lines that the so-called parrot in this poem quotes. So here it goes. And I do the parrot's voice, I have to warn you. I apologize in advance. Parrot, you'd sit quietly, and the parrot would cry, "Death is the mother of beauty." And then she'd nod and eat a burrito. She was taciturn, but if you pushed her, she'd become fiery and shout, "My life had stood a loaded gun," and fan her feathers. What do you have to say that is more suited to natural discourse than the parrot's glittering images? What do you have to say that could not be bettered by, "The world is too much with us. Sunset and evening star. We real cool." "And they feed, they lie and grow." Or, "Whose woods these are, I do not know. I do not know." Oh, sorry. "I do not know. The I'm sorry, I'm so bad. "I do not know," the parrot shouts. "I honestly do not know. But I am so tired of repeating the same profound, shimmering insights and nobody listening." Thank you for listening.
A Loud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, Deloitte, K&L Gates, KPMG, Wallace Foundation, the Bujakchi Foundation, Dean Hansel, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC, 83.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. A Loud theme composed by Larry Karish.